This is Setting the Record Straight. This is Chuck Coughlin. And just for you, this is BreadboxMedia.com. We're in our infancy, but it's a very robust and healthy infant. We're going great places, folks. Stick with us. In a moment, you and I are going to be thinking a bit about the 15th century. But let's say a word about what went right before that. The High Middle Ages can be said to be the most glorious time of Western European civilization. One could call it the Age of Illumination. It was followed by the Renaissance. Contrary to what you have heard, in important ways, the Renaissance was a time of irrationality. It was during the Renaissance that alchemy reached its height. Astrology grew ever more influential. Because of Catholicism, women had achieved an unprecedentedly high status. A great deal of their progress was reversed, for the Renaissance meant the reawakening, the rebirth of patriarchal Roman law. The persecution of witches, erroneously associated with the Middle Ages, became widespread only during the 15th and 16th centuries. During the Renaissance, secularism was on the rise, yet the vast bulk of the artistic work during the Renaissance is religious. And the best of it comes from the most famous names in the history of European art, whose art was inspired by sincere and profound religious faith. Today's Setting Records Straight is covering a period in the 1500s. And we're talking about the Habsburg Emperor, Charles V, an extraordinary man, and sometimes not well treated by historians, especially disliked by Protestants. But Charles V was a man for his time. He held Christianity together in a very difficult period. Here stood Western Europe, united as Christendom, exploring new continents, reaching its cultural apogee in the Renaissance, and about to be blown to smithereens by a disgruntled monk. Who that is, you're going to see in a minute. There was one man who exerted every sinew of his being to hold Christendom together, to hold Catholicdom together, usually called Christendom. One man who simultaneously kept the Turks, the Muslims, out of Europe, waylaid the Islamic corsairs who were raiding the Mediterranean and making trade impossible. And this man, more devotedly than anyone, sought to defend the Orthodox Catholic faith and keep Christianity from being smashed into squabbling sects, at least for a while. I said he was not well treated by historians, but he's the man that did all this. The papacy feared his strength while it relied on his muscle. He was the perfect embodiment of Renaissance Catholic civilization outside Italy. So in case you can't quite remember what happened before you were born, say in the 1500s, first of all, what was the Holy Roman Empire? Well, the title Holy Roman Empire is misleading. One historian said it was neither holy nor Roman. But what it was a multi-ethnic complex of territories in Central Europe, covered a pretty large area. And it developed nearly early Middle Ages and continued for centuries until its dissolution in 1806, almost modern times. The precise term Holy Roman Empire was not used until the 13th century. And it was developed on the notion that the ruler inherited supreme powers from the emperors of Rome. This was not an empire under the church, but frequently allied and sometimes contesting with the Catholic Church. And of course, there were papal states, land areas governed by the Pope. Now, the office of Holy Roman Emperor was traditionally elective, although frequently controlled by dynasties, which are generations and relationships of families that were rulers, or noble rulers. So the German prince electors, they were called, groups of princes, were the highest ranking noblemen in the Holy Roman Empire, and they usually elected one of their peers as king of the Romans. And this person would later be crowned emperor by the Pope. The tradition of being crowned by the Pope was discontinued in the 16th century. And of course, they spoke Latin as their basic language. So that's the Holy Roman Empire. The second name and concept I want you to recall for a few minutes is Charles V. He ruled from 1519 until around 1556, a long period. And he was the heir of three of Europe's leading dynasties, the most famous, the House of Habsburg. Charles was very accomplished. Much of his reign was devoted to Italian wars, the wars in Italy against France, which, although enormously expensive, were successful and led to the development of the first modern professional army in Europe, the Tercios. Now, aside from his military endeavors, Charles V was best known for his role in opposing the Protestant Reformation. Several German princes abandoned the Catholic Church and formed a league in order to challenge Charles' authority with military force. Charles was not willing to allow the wars of religion to come to his other domains, and he pushed for the convocation of the Council of Trent, which began the Counter-Reformation that I'm sure you're familiar with. Of course, we've talked just in a recent program about the Society of Jesus being formed at this time, the Jesuits, formed by St. Ignatius of Loyola. That was done during Charles's reign. And it was done in order to peacefully and intellectually combat Protestantism. And continental Spain was spared from religious conflict, largely by Charles V's nonviolent measures. In the New World, Spain conquered the Aztecs of Mexico and the Incas of Peru, and extended its control across much of Central and South America. Charles even provided 5 ships to Ferdinand Magellan, whose voyage was the first time the Earth was circumnavigated, and that laid the foundation for the Pacific Oceanic Empire of Spain. Charles V spent practically all his time at war, but it wasn't his choice. He was a lover of peace. A historian wrote, he was not greedy of territory, but most greedy of peace and quiet. When Charles V was 56 years old, he was worn out after all these years of rule, and he was physically exhausted and sought the peace of a monastery where he died a few years later at age 58. He ruled for 34 years. So let's get back to our story. So Charles V came from the House of Habsburg, a German-Swiss-Austrian family that now, through marriage, had brought the Netherlands, Spain, and Spain's new world possession into one enormous empire, upon which the sun never set. That's a phrase the Habsburgs could claim before the British Empire. The family was imperial and Catholic and had a familial sense of a shared European culture. Now, Charles' primary language was French, but his brother Ferdinand preferred Spanish. By blood, they were German. When Charles defended the faith before Luther's assaults, he did so as one born of the most Christian emperors of the noble German nation, of the Catholic kings of Spain, the Archdukes of Austria, the Dukes of Burgundy, who were all to the death true sons of the Roman Catholic Church, defenders of the Catholic faith, of the sacred customs, decrees, and usages of worship, which have been bequeathed to all of us, to you and me, as our heritage. Another inheritance that Charles left us was an order of chivalry called the Order of the Golden Fleece, which in true Renaissance style combined classical imagery with Catholic purpose. You might go back to the podcast and listen to chivalry. I've gotten a lot of good comments on that one. The Golden Fleece was transposed with the Lamb of God and the Argonauts with the Crusades. When Charles fought the Muslim Turks in North Africa, his victory was celebrated as a repeat of Rome, triumphing over Carthage, complete with a triumphal parade in the Eternal City. His favorite book, Thucydides' History of the Peloponnesian War. In his retirement, he translated French chivalric poetry into Spanish. He was elected Holy Roman Emperor in 1519. Now, the Pope had wanted a French emperor. The Pope regarded the French as the traditional necessary check on the power of the Holy Roman Empire, which was sometimes threatening to the Church. This was Pope Leo X. But under the Habsburg, the empire would sweep across the entirety of Europe from Spain to Austria, with Charles also heir to much of Italy through the Kingdom of Naples and the city of Milan, placing Rome and the Pope directly between the jaws of the most powerful lion in Christendom. But it didn't turn out as the Pope had feared. Charles became the Catholic Church and Catholic Doom's most ardent defender. At the Diet of Worms, 20-year-old Charles V condemned the rebellious monk Martin Luther by his imperial right to punish heresy. He He was Pope Leo X's ally in the war against France when the French became a greater threat to the papal lands, the papal states. He remained loyal to the church even when he was vacillating. Later, Pope Clement VII turned against him out of fear, allying the papacy with France in the independent states of Italy. But when the French were defeated and Francis I was captured, Charles' imperial troops in Italy, many of whom were Lutherans, grew so angry at the poor conditions they were in that they slipped from their officers' control and sacked Rome for 8 days in 1527. So in this way, the Lutherans sacked Rome in 1527. They hanged one future pope, Julius III, by his hair and raped, robbed, pillaged, and killed thousands of people. Well, before this imperial sack of Rome, the papacy had viewed the Lutheran revolt as just a distraction from the immense battles that had continued with the Turks, the Muslims. But now the Pope was finally confronted with the full brutal reality of Protestantism in arms, something that Charles, the sovereign of Germany, knew all too well. Since Luther's break with the Church, the main Protestant contribution to civilization had been the bloodiest peasant uprising in the history of Europe. That was over a period of 2 years, around 1524. This uprising devastated Germany. Now Lutheran troops defaced the Vatican, dressed themselves as clerics, held mock and sacrilegious Catholic ceremonies, kidnapped the Pope, and even threatened to eat him. After that experience, Pope Clement found it easier to accept Charles as an ally against their common enemy, the Turks.
As you well know, this is BreadboxMedia.com. We're setting the record straight about events of the 15th century. This is Chuck Coughlin. We're going to take just a bit of a break.
Breadbox Media invites you to Bless the Yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit breadboxmedia.com.
Yes, we're back after the break. Setting the record straight, Chuck Coughlin. Glad to see you still sitting there. Let's go on. Remember what we were saying? The Lutherans were sacking Rome, pulling all sorts of stunts. Dressed themselves as clerics, held mock and sacrilegious Catholic ceremonies, kidnapped the Pope, and even threatened to eat him. After that experience, Pope Clement found it easier to accept Charles as an ally against their common enemy, the Turks. The Pope's priority was repelling the Turks, who had overrun Hungary, and that was a lot more important than defeating the Protestants, who had overrun Germany. And he felt these new schismatics could eventually be reconciled. The Turks had to be stopped. So there was an initial showdown. One side, the Holy Roman Empire, and the other side, the Turks, who were attacking and besieging Vienna, 1529. Well, the odds were stiff against the defending Catholic army. The Turks were under Suleiman the Magnificent, no less. They brought 120,000 men and unmatched heavy artillery against not quite 17,000 Catholic soldiers. I'll repeat, 120,000 against 17,000 Catholic soldiers. Even the disparity in number doesn't reflect the full odds against the Catholic forces. Their Emperor Charles was like the Dutch boy, trying to plug every hole in the dike of Christian civilization, while mischievous troublemakers relentlessly poked him with cattle prods. Tickling Charles's back was a sword wielded by the French king, Francis I, secretly allied with the Turk. In Francis, every mischievous attempts to upend the emperor who overshadowed the glory of France. In the emperor's own heartland, Germany, Protestant princes cheered the relentless Muslim and Ottoman advance, for theirs was a shared goal of shattering the Catholic Church in Christendom like a glass. To the east, as the Ottomans occupied Hungary, where the Turks were made slaves of thousands and left areas desolate of human life, the collaborationist Hungarians assisted the Ottoman Muslims against the Catholic power. that would liberate Austria and Hungary. But what happened? Well, catch this. Charles V was a true wonder, an atlas, who trusted that his armies, wherever and whenever they fought, against whatever numbers, would succeed in slapping away every threat to Christendom, to a Europe united by the Catholic Church. The Catholic commanders at Vienna were Count Nicholas von Salm and Marshal Wilhelm von Roggendorf. Their troops, tough German-speaking regulars, professionals, mercenaries, and other kinds of German soldiers, as well as 700 elite Spanish gunmen led by Luis de Lavalos. By the time the Catholic soldiers had taken their positions and built the defensive works, the city was entirely surrounded. It was an island in an Ottoman sea. This is the defense of Vienna. But Vienna was an island from which the Austrian defenders made occasional, daring sallies that threw the besiegers into panic. Away from the cannon, bowmen, and sharpshooters, half the battle was fought underground in tunnels beneath the city and the encircling Ottoman camp. The Austrians stuffed explosives down Turkish mine shafts or met the Ottomans in claustrophobic hand-to-hand combat. For 2 weeks, the battle carried on. The Austrians fiercely determined, the Turks frustrated, exasperated, and finally beaten. On their retreat, the Turks slaughtered thousands of Christian hostages. This was an outrage to the Catholic chivalrous soldiers. And they mounted a pursuit and harried the Ottoman retreat into a full-fledged disaster of abandoned wagons, animals, and the Moslems lying dead in the first deep Austrian snows of that winter. As the ancient Romans held back the Parthians, so the Holy Roman Empire held back the Turk. Christendom was saved for the moment, at least from its external enemies. But the Turks were a continual call on the military forces of the Holy Roman Empire. Not only were troops engaged in Austria-Hungary, they were also engaged along the Mediterranean coastline. It was here that where the Knights of the Golden Fleece found allies in the Knights Hospitaller, who had patrolled the eastern Mediterranean for two centuries. During that time, the Hospitallers had been headquartered on the island of Rhodes, daringly close to the Turkish mainland. Too close, it turned out, to withstand the final great siege of Rhodes mounted by the Turks. So heroic was the Knights' defense that Charles V said of it that nothing in the world was so well lost as Rhodes. The chivalric emperor, at the request of Pope Clement VII, gave the Knights a new base. It was the island of Malta. 5 years later, Charles himself led a brilliant and victorious campaign against Tunis, which was at that time the capital of Islam's piracy, which was ravaging the Mediterranean. So this defeat of Tunis was very significant. But it seemed like no victory was ever final. It's always seemed like that. Charles spent his entire reign defending against Turks in the east, the French in the west, and the Protestants in the north. I said earlier he was a man that loved peace, but he didn't get it. All the while, the French, Turks, and even the mercantile city-states of Italy sometimes made overt common cause against him. All this wore him down, and he began transferring power to his brother Ferdinand when he was in his 50s, and also to his son Philip II of Spain. He eased into retirement and indulged his love of art and religion rather than practicing war and diplomacy. As I said, he died soon after. He had kept with him a portrait of his late wife and the works of Titian, his favorite painter. After receiving the final oils, the sacrament of extra-unction, he asked to attend a mass. The priest told him, "That's not necessary," Charles commented. "It may not be necessary, but it is good company for so long a journey." He died clasping the same crucifix that his wife had held when she breathed her last. Charles' greatest victories had been those of a crusader against the Turks. With the Protestants as subjects in northern Germany, he had long hoped for a rapprochement, for achieving a peace and unity through an ecumenical council called by the Pope. But there was little room for negotiation. The chief issue of the Protestant Reformation was never better expressed than by Charles himself when he said of Luther, "It is preposterous that a single monk should be right in his opinion and that the whole of Christianity should be in error 1,000 years or more." Well, maybe it was preposterous, but powerful forces supported it. And in the end, they created a sort of moronic inferno that left a chasm of fire between the historic faith of the Catholic Church and endless fragmenting of the varieties of Protestantism. Oh, we're now about to consider the worst cataclysm to descend upon Europe since the sack of Rome in 410. And we're at the time of the Protestant Reformation in the 1500s. It was no accident when the dust settled upon the wars of the Reformation. The wars of the Reformation lasted more than a century. So it was no accident that Catholic Europe had retrenched itself behind the old borders of the Roman Empire. Of course, it is true that North Africa and the Middle East and many of the provinces east of the Adriatic now belong to the Muslims, and under their yoke could be found the Eastern Orthodox Catholic Church. But the heart of the empire of Augustus Trajan and Marcus Aurelius remained Catholic. Italy, France, Spain, Austria, and what would become Belgium and southern and western Germany. And also, joining that empire was Hungary and Poland and most of Ireland, England, linked to Rome since invasion by Caesar 55 years before Christ, was separated from the faith almost by accident. The English king, King Henry VIII, was such a vocal opponent of Martin Luther that Pope Leo X awarded him the title of the Defender of the Faith. Henry VIII died thinking of himself as a Catholic. The Anglican settlement that was finally reached under Elizabeth I, when an Act of Parliament created the English Church, created a national church that claimed to be both Protestant and simultaneously part of the one holy Catholic and apostolic church. Beyond Hadrian's Wall, where the Romans had feared to tread, there was no such ambience. The blue-painted Scots adopted the starker creed of John Calvin and John Knox. So in this way, the Protestant revolt took power in what had been the barbarian provinces beyond the gates of Rome, in countries with fewer centuries of high civilization and Christianity. The Nordic countries, northern Germany, parts of old Switzerland, parts of what became the Netherlands and Scotland. All these barbaric peoples who had mocked at the legions of Rome and later plundered Rome now rose again in a new barbarian assault against the Roman authority. Their objective was overturning the Roman power, not reconciling with it. This great effort took place under the man we're talking about, Charles V. And it's interesting, he was a Roman of a barbarian bloodline, trying desperately to plug every hole in Rome's defense. And who was the new adversary of Rome? It was that ill-tempered, unbalanced, unhappy monk, Martin Luther, who himself said that his monastery in Wittenberg, Saxony, was just 1 mile from the barbarians. Martin Luther meant this symbolically as well as actually. Luther propounded a barbarian creed that had no need for priests or their sacraments, something better suited to frontier peoples, he felt. As the barbarians saw Rome as decadent and unworthy of their support, so did the Protestants see Roman Catholics as decadent, its wayward clergy too corrupt to offer sacramental grace. While Catholics viewed the priesthood and the sacraments as a historical continuity of their incarnational faith, the expression of an entire Christian civilization, the Protestants saw a celibate priesthood and most of the sacraments as irrelevant as Christian art, pagan philosophy, and an authoritative church. In Luther's view, the people themselves will become the priesthood of all believers. The father and founder of this priesthood, Martin Luther, was originally a servant of the church, though not out of a sense of fidelity or spiritual calling. He became a monk to escape and affront his abusive parents, both of whom beat him severely. Luther's father was not a Catholic, but an occultist who believed in darker German witches, hobgoblins, and demons. On that happy note, we must take a break. This is Setting Record Straight with Chuck Coughlin.
Breadbox Media invites you to Bless the Yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit breadboxmedia.com.
Thank you.
on breadboxmedia.com.
This is Setting the Record Straight. We're back with you, Chuck Coughlin. We were talking about Martin Luther. Martin Luther was originally a servant of the church, though not out of a sense of fidelity or spiritual calling. He became a monk to escape and affront his abusive parents, both of whom beat him severely. Luther's father was not a Catholic, but an occultist who believed in darker German witches, hobgoblins, and demons. These would also haunt the imagination of Martin Luther, who had visions, which he believed to be actual physical occurrences of the devil hurling feces at him, and his hurling it back. Indeed, in one of his many anal combats with the devil, in which Luther would challenge the devil to lick his posterior, Luther thought the best tactic might be to throw him into my anus where he belongs. How one wishes for an exorcist by Dr. Sigmund Freud of that passage. Luther's mind and manner, needless to say, were not those of a noble, polished Renaissance courtier, but those of a tough, gnarled, ham-fisted, working-class Northern German. Being in the words of a historian, the most anal of theologians, it is not surprised that, like the American president Lyndon Baines Johnson, Luther conducted his business while defecating. His thunderbolt idea that faith alone was sufficient for salvation came in his own words, as knowledge the Holy Spirit gave me on the privy in the tower. But Luther had brains. He was smart. He was ordained a priest, became a doctor of theology. Initially, he was so thoroughly in favor of the papacy that he professed his desire to be the most brutal murderer on the Pope's behalf and to kill all who even by syllable refused submission to the Pope. Well, this was while he was also disregarding the guidance of his confessor, the rules of his monastery, and traditional Catholic teaching in his excessive forms of penance and refusal to believe that he had been absolved of sin, Luther was prone to panic attacks. He could not look upon a crucifix. He tried to avoid performing a mass or being in the presence of a blessed sacrament. His life was one continual terror of damnation. Then came his revelation on the privy, and he felt he had broken free of his own sinfulness, not by the sacraments of the church, but by faith alone. As Luther says, very arrestingly, be a sinner and sin on bravely, but have stronger faith and rejoice in Christ, who is the victor of sin, death, and the world. Do not for a moment imagine that this life is the abiding place of justice. Sin must be committed. To you it ought to be suffered. To you it ought to be sufficient that you acknowledge the Lamb that takes away the sins of the world. The sin cannot tear you away from him. Even though you commit adultery 100 times a day and commit as many murders. Well, it's often said by Catholics as well as Protestants that the Church of the Renaissance was crying out for reform. With its abuse of indulgences, its sale of church offices, the laughable mass market for false relics, the nepotism that appointed children as cardinals, the low standard of morality and education for much of the clergy, and et cetera, et cetera. That's all true. But it's also possible, just as we do today, to exaggerate the Church's corruption and to neglect to mention its unchanging orthodoxy, its care for the sick and the poor, its leadership of Europe, its restraint on government power, and its patronage of the arts and learning. Most of all, as we see with Luther, we need to remember that it was not the Catholic Church of the Renaissance that freely forgave adultery and murder, let alone 100 times, merely on the grounds that the sinner was a professed Christian. Whatever the shameful traffic in indulgences to raise money for the church, at a minimum, even the purchaser of an indulgence had to confess these crimes against man and God to a priest in the confessional. The indulgence only relieved him of the otherwise obligatory penance. It was his penance. Until Luther, all believers accepted the sacrament of penance, of making restitution either by a fine or an indulgence, or by fasting or prayer, or by accepting service of the Crusades or so on. It had been a keystone of Christendom, a discipline that made even the mighty monarchs perform pilgrimages on their knees. It had been one of the great motivating factors of the public piety of the Middle Ages. making it the age of faith. Its very spirit was compellingly captured by Shakespeare in his play Henry V, when the king pleads with God to remember his works, not his faith alone, on behalf of the church before the Battle of Agincourt. This is the quote from Henry V. Not today, O Lord. Oh, not today, think not upon the fault my father made in compassing the crown. I, Richard's body, have interred new, and on it have bestowed more contrite tears than from it issued forced drops of blood. 500 poor I have in yearly pay, who twice a day in their withered hands hold up toward heaven to pardon blood. And I have built two chantries where the sad and solemn priests sing still for Richard's soul. More will I do, though all I can do is nothing worth, since that my penitence comes after all imploring pardon. So that's what Shakespeare wrote. Sounds like he's a Catholic, imploring pardon? Well, there's pretty convincing evidence that Shakespeare was indeed a Catholic. With Luther, all that wasn't necessary. A murderer could raise his blood-stained hands to heaven and say, "Thank God I'm a Christian." If the murderer is one of the elect, for Luther believed in predestination, he was assuredly saved. The murderer, in any event, was not responsible for his actions, because Luther, unlike the Catholic Church, denied that man had free will. These ideas of Luther's were, as history would later show, unfortunately extremely dangerous. As a reformer, Luther was not a lone voice crying out in the wilderness. The church knew it had become worldly, and it could acknowledge the genius of some of its critics. The most celebrated Catholic intellectual of this time was Erasmus, who wrote virulent satires against the church to which he nevertheless clung, and which, at least while he was alive, praised his wit, wide reading, and humanistic attitude toward reform. He was even offered, but declined, a cardinal's hat. He had a ready stream of invitations to adorn the court of any Catholic king, or the Pope for that matter. But Luther, as Erasmus eventually saw, was not offering words to an educated elite, chiding them to reform. He was preaching a peasant's revolt against Renaissance civilization and learning. Erasmus wrote, "Where Lutheranism flourishes, the sciences perish." Piercing beneath the motivations of Luther's followers, Erasmus saw that for them the overthrow of the terrestrial power of the church was motivated by a greed for church property, a lust to break the bonds of celibacy. Lutheranism had but two objects at heart, Erasmus said, money and women. It was also a movement of inevitable violence. As the Duke of Saxony warned Luther, his doctrine of by faith alone would only make people presumptuous and mutinous. When Luther posted his 95 theses on the church door, his immediate cause of protest was the sale of indulgences by a Dominican friar. The man's name was John Tertzel, and his mission had been to raise money in part for the rebuilding of St. Peter's Cathedral. Tertzel was a great preacher. He packed in the peasant faithful. His commercial pitch, however, went far beyond the bounds of propriety and canon law, if not common practice. It echoed, in an odd way, Luther's own doctrines of salvation by faith alone. That was the irony. Tertzel merely gave that saving faith a monetary value, a material form. "Anything could be forgiven," said Tertzel, "if a punter paid his money and bought a papal indulgence." So Luther struck at this fat and disreputable target. It was not an unusual occurrence for churchmen and academicians to publicly post theses and then debate them. This was a time of rhetorical debate. This time, a rhetorical firestorm erupted. The tinder had been laid by the rising nationalism in Europe. That nationalism set out to subordinate the church. In the eyes of some, an Italian church, as it had been a French Catholic, while the Pope was in residence at Avignon. This would lead 200 years later to the Protestant doctrine of separation of church and state. 200 years after that, to the irrelevance of church to state. There was also the resentment of papal taxation, corruption, and luxury. Christendom's kings followed a low-tax regimen. No monarchy from the Middle Ages until the Democratic Age ever taxed its subjects by more than 10%. Often, as in Catholic England, it taxed them not at all. High taxes are an invention of democracies, republican and socialist governments, to pay for such services as schools, hospitals, and caring for the poor that under the Catholic monarchies had been the province of the church, and to pay for things like armies, which had been paid for by the royal families and noblemen out of their own pockets. But the absence of royal taxes meant that the Catholic Church's demands for money to pay for social services, or for the monasteries or cathedrals, or for rebuilding Rome, or for assembling crusades, all these stood out as a burden imposed by power centered in Italy. A burden that increasingly nationalistic nobles and people resented. There was a new spirit of emancipation that recoiled from the complexity of civilization, history, and especially from the authoritative church. So we'll break again on Setting the Record Straight with Chuck Coughlin. See you in a few minutes.
Redbox Media invites you to Bless the Yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit BreadboxMedia.com.
We're back after the break. This is Setting the Record Straight with Chuck Coughlin. So what did this Lutheran Protestantism want? The church was the center of spiritual power in Christendom. So it wanted the church stripped of such power. In part, it regarded the Renaissance as paganism and sought to separate and degrade pagan learning from the Bible alone as the source of authority. The result over time was that in Protestant countries, theology was no longer the queen of the sciences, but only one source of knowledge subject to individual interpretation and was separated from secular inquiry. Because secular inquiry was seen as objective, it eventually gained predominance and prestige over doctrinal subjective Protestant religious thought. This intellectual development has been the major factor in secularizing the Western world. This was the invention of the separation of church and state, which led to the state over the church and then sidelining the church. Just as damaging to Christianity was the Protestant desire to wrench Christianity from history, or what was seen as centuries of encrusted superstition. Salvation was now to be found in a single book, the Bible, and in the distant practice of an imagined, unstained, and primitive church. And then began their many fantasies about the nature of this primitive church, this unstained primitive church. Jimmy Akins has a wonderful book about this that quotes the church fathers on various subjects, but these paragraphs are ordered by chapter headings. The book is called The Fathers Know Best. I'm delighted with this book. It's a very good answer to our separated brethren, the Protestants, who have this false image of the Catholic Church as different from the Catholic Church that exists now. Look at Jimmy's book, The Fathers Know Best, and you'll see that it's very much the same church. We dress differently. We're speaking in the vernacular, not in Latin. But it's the same dogmas. It's the same theology. The same honoring of Mary. The same more complex approach to salvation. So by the 18th and 19th centuries, mainline Protestant scholars took a similarly critical attitude to the Bible, scraping at it until it appeared as full of errors and superstition as the Roman Catholic Church itself. Protestantism thus became one of the main solvents for scrubbing away any faith that went beyond a general social gospel of good intentions. But that lay in the future. Martin Luther did not foresee this, but he was a man of conflict rather than of foresight. Luther had not at this point entirely broken with Rome. While he dismissed Julius II, Alexander VI, as inferior popes, he wrote to Pope Leo X in loyalty and submission to the church discipline. In this protestation, however, Luther was less than honest. He swore he would accept his own death if the Pope ordered it. But when Leo beckoned him to Rome, Luther shied away. Nor did Luther confide in the Pope that in his private correspondence, he was already linking the office of the papacy to the Antichrist. While Erasmus had his own doubts about the powers of the papacy, he trusted that reform would come from well-read, classically educated, humanist popes like Leo. Luther, on the other hand, was a violent debater, pounding his cudgels wherever they would make the most resounding racket. The Pope, inclined by temperament to listen to Erasmus and ignore Luther regarding this noisy German as a mere distraction, the Pope had more pressing business with the German princes, who had refused his demand to pay taxes and offer men for a crusade against the Turks. Leo was committed to winning them over and enlisting the Scandinavian kingdoms for his crusade as well. To dispense with Luther, Leo ordered that instead of coming to Rome, the monks should face an inquiry at Augsburg. And if he repented of any unorthodox statements, he was to be forgiven and the whole business forgotten. Inevitably, Luther and the Pope's emissaries quarreled. Still, Pope Leo took the initiative in reforming the church precisely on the point Luther had attacked. He clarified the Catholic practice on indulgences, reminding the faithful they could not buy their way to heaven. Indulgences were merely forms of penance, alms offered for forgiveness of temporal punishment. Certainly not a blank check for sins to be committed or to buy the freedom of a soul in purgatory. Luther again affirmed his submission to the Pope while concealing his continuing doubts about whether the Pope is the Antichrist or his apostle. The full break came when, in public debate, Luther denied the primacy of the Pope, held the Council of Constance in error, and even praised some of the doctrines of Juan Hus. He now had moved from being one of the many vocal church reformers, though easily the most politically powerful, because of anti-papal sentiment among the people and princes in Germany, to being a Hussite heretic. Even so, Leo made no move against Luther. The tolerant Renaissance Pope still assumed that matters could be patched over. Christendom, he believed, faced a far more dangerous threat from the Turks, whose armies were separated from Italy only by the narrow Adriatic Sea to the east and hard-pressed Austria to the north. But it is the frequent misfortune of tolerant, high-minded, and far-seeing men to be attacked by petty, narrow, and ruthless ones, who generally have mobs at their sides. This was the case with Pope Leo and Martin Luther. Luther wrote, "Why do we not attack in arms these masters of perdition, these cardinals, these popes, and all this sink of the Roman Sodom, which has without end corrupted the Church of God, and wash our hands in their blood?" Well, there is the voice of reformist Christianity as preached by Luther. So Leo condemned Luther's writings, but offered him another chance to recant. Instead, Luther responded by addressing the German people, praising Germany's rulers. Then Luther declared that every man was his own priest. This doctrine and its corollary that every man should interpret the Bible for himself not only made subjectivism and moral relativism a foundation of the Protestant doctrines, but a crucial point. This allowed Luther to blatantly subvert any sense of restraint that secular princes felt in attacking the clergy or the Pope. In Luther's mind, the religious hierarchy of the church deserved no special esteem and no independence under its own canon law from the state law. Canon law, in Luther's view, was merely the law laid down by the Antichrist in Rome. The great medieval achievements of Christendom, of curbing and redirecting the martial spirit of barbarian Europe by transforming the Gothic warrior into the Frankish knight and subordinating him to unarmed priests and making him kneel before the bearer of the cross, all this work was undone. If Luther had been in New Spain, he would have told the conquistadors to put the priests in their place, because the authority of the state was founded in Scripture, while the authority of the Pope and the clergy was not. Deference to the clergy was not a Lutheran virtue, because the established clergy served the Antichrist in Rome. The real church, according to Luther, was an invisible institution held only in the faith of men. The state, the German princes, the German Reich, was the only true temporal reality, and it was to it, not to the Church of Rome, that men in law should be subordinate. In Luther's words, no one need think that the world can be ruled without blood. The civil sword shall and must be red and bloody. In Luther, we see the historic German view of blood and iron, of might making right, an inevitable conclusion for the supremacy of the nation state over the church. But more than that, we see in Luther's repeating current in German history, the desire of Germans to be free from outside constraints imposed by the church, a barbarian yearning for radical moral reform, recognizing the authority only of the state, of the barbarian chieftain, of the great man. It was true in the endless conflicts between the Holy Roman Empire and the papacy. It was true in the earthquake war between Frederick II, the wonder of the world, and the Pope. It was true now with Luther, as it would be true later with Bismarck and his culture war, his Kulturkampf against the power of the Catholic Church in Germany in the century before Hitler. And it was again true with Nietzsche, who proclaimed the death of God, the inversion of all values, and the birth of the Superman freed from Christianity. It was the Germans' desire for in all thoughts and actions to be free of the reins of the church, to be free of the inhibitions of the church. Yet again, with Germans' heathen heart, which Kipling saw, putting its trust in reeking tuba and iron shard, in his poem Recessional, and finally with Hitler, Even Reformed Protestant historians have linked Luther's dismissal of moral law on the basis of salvation by faith alone with the eventual rise of the Third Reich, the Führer, Adolf Hitler. Luther was an avowed enemy of reason. He repudiated the Catholic tradition of natural law, the scholasticism of St. Thomas Aquinas, the philosophy of Aristotle. He called that heathen plague. All the grand intellectual superstructure of Catholicism was unbiblical and unnecessary to Luther. It, too, fell before Luther's assault on the church's role in reconciling sinners to God. By church teaching, no sin is merely personal. It's an affront to God and inevitably harms God's creation, one's family, one's friends, and one's neighbors. A priest acting in persona Christi, acting in person of Christ, granting forgiveness in Christ's name and admonishing the sinner to sin no more, giving him penance as a means to expiate temporal punishment due to sin. Instead, Luther propounded a doctrine more in line with late 20th century notions of, quote, self-esteem and of lawlessness for the proud. For example, quote, Christianity is nothing but a perpetual exercise in feeling that you have no sin, although you committed sin, and that your sins are attached to Christ. In this way, Protestant Christendom became the long march into the individualistic secularism of the modern world.
This is BreadboxMedia.com.
This has been Setting the Record Straight with Chuck Coughlin. Thank you for listening.